What happens here, I believe, is Peter comes to the very end and he writes and says, I've written briefly, exhorting and testifying that this is the true grace of God wherein ye stand. I think we see Peter here, as he mentioned in verse 1 of this chapter, that he said, I am also an elder. I'm also a bishop. I'm also a pastor. I have a pastoral concern. I'm writing to you out of pastoral concern. And I believe that as he concludes here, he's really trying to crystallize a pastoral concern for them because they were suffering. And it is so possible when we suffer, when we're hurting, to get discouraged, to begin to question, to begin to doubt, to be afraid. That, I believe, is his pastoral concern here. And it's like he's given all of this truth, but he concludes and he says, hey, I have written briefly in a few words to both, you know, challenge you, I want to exhort you, and to testify that this, what I've written to you, this is the true grace of God. That's what I want to drill down on here today. This idea of truth and grace, both together. We can sometimes be wondering, we can be tempted to question when we suffer, is my faith wrong? You know, am I believing something wrong? Is there something messed up in my life? I mean, is God mad at me? Is this suffering my fault? And Peter concludes with this very strong exhortation and testimony. This is the true grace of God wherein ye stand. He reinforces what he's been saying all along. And what he's saying all along is, don't focus on the suffering. Don't focus on what's happening to you. But rather turn your eyes to our gracious God who is sustaining you. He emphasizes that this is the true grace of God. It's not false. It's not misunderstood. It's not somehow a faith that's misplaced. But rather this that I'm writing to you about grace, it is the true grace of God. We might put it this way in a pushback against our culture, and especially Christian culture, I'm afraid, today. He's saying this is the true grace of God. It's not just some kind of a positive mental attitude. I'm not writing to you to just put on a happy face. Just kind of act like, yeah, everything's okay. When everything's not okay. Because when we're suffering, especially in their situation, when the suffering is inflicted, persecution against you because of your faith, how then do you sustain your faith? How do you sustain that? It's putting on the happy face isn't going to cut it. Just putting on a mask that says all is well when it's not well. We're not going to be able to fake that when we're really suffering. I want to encourage you today to be aware of a very dangerous and false view of grace that is very prevalent in our culture. It is a false view that somehow separates grace from truth. Let me try to give you some examples. Not to be horribly controversial, and I just hope that as I mentioned these, that you don't so focus on these that you miss the rest of the message. But just to try to illustrate how our culture can separate grace or try to separate grace from truth. We live in a culture right now, we are in a historical moment right now, where there is a tremendous emphasis on trying to be, I'm using the word grace, trying to be gracious. Let me give you, here's one example. What do you think about this? Our president before our current president popularized, at least he's the first one that I heard this from, he popularized the statement, you ought to be able to marry the one you love. You know, that's just trying to be gracious to someone. And you understand where he was going with that and what the background of that is. What's the problem with that statement? I mean, it really is a very gracious statement. But it's completely devoid of the truth. The truth is not merely that God hates same-sex relations or something like that. That's not merely the truth. The truth is that there is a loving, gracious, kind God who has told us how life will work well. And when we violate that and go against that truth, we do it to our destruction. It doesn't change God. Grace without truth. Do you get what I'm trying to illustrate there? I'm sorry. How about this one? We are taught in our culture today, and I don't want to get off on this. This isn't the message. I want to get back to 1 Peter. But I'm just trying to illustrate this prevalence of grace with the absence of truth. We are taught today that we need to be accepting of folks who were born one way, physically, DNA, scientifically, indisputable, this person is a certain gender. But now they're saying, no, I identify with this gender. We are to graciously accept them. Any contradiction of that is considered hate speech. What's the problem with it? The problem is, as gracious as it might be, it's devoid of truth, say. In the Bible, there is no distinction between grace and truth like that. These are not two concepts that are completely separated from each other. In fact, in the book of John, the Gospel of John, the very first chapter, in the introducing us to Jesus, who is the Word made flesh, it's verse 14, where the Scripture says, "The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." That does not mean that he was 50% grace and 50% truth. And sometimes grace won out and sometimes truth won out. No. He was full of grace and he was full of truth. It's both. Grace we would tend to think of as being, you know, very kind to the undeserving, because that's what it is. Truth, it would tend to be, well, no, that's more along the line of justice without mercy or grace. That's not true. When the Bible says that Jesus was full of grace and truth, that's who God is. He's a God of perfect, absolute, undeniable grace, but at the same time of truth. And only God, if I could put it this way, pulls that off perfectly. We struggle with that, both grace and truth. Let me give you another example. Let's say, now I'm hitting some really good controversies here. Okay, so we'll move on from this. But here's another one. You might have political views about this, and I don't care about your political views. Well, maybe I do, but I'll just say, please don't hunker down on this and get mad at me. It's just an illustration, whatever you think about it. Minimum wage. I'm not going to comment for or against it. But the idea that everyone should get a minimum wage, whether they work well or not, whether they make money for the company or not, whether they wear the uniform or not, whether they just show up on time or not, whether they take too long of breaks, whether they have a rotten attitude or not, but that everybody should get a minimum wage, that is so gracious. But it just is removed from the truth of everything else that I just said. Where pretty soon we just level the playing field. And in our culture, it's considered to be gracious. Here's another one. Now, this might be even closer to home, but I really have a big problem with this. Here you have a soccer team, and maybe some of you have already done this. No offense. Don't tell me. No, but I don't think it's sinfully wrong. We have a soccer team, a little league team or whatever. I mean, when I grew up, I was big into sports and I played little league, and you know, you'd try to hit the ball, you'd try to catch the ball, you'd try to not make errors, you'd come to practice, you'd try to work out, you'd try to do the very best that you can, and one team won. Today, everyone gets a trophy. And what's wrong with that? Nothing. There's nothing wrong with that. Except it's a reflection of our culture that says we want to treat everyone the same. We're not the same. The person that worked hard, the person who has ability, the person who was an outstanding athlete, he might stink at academics. But for everybody to get a trophy, then pretty soon everybody gets an A. That's not true. That's not helpful. What's wrong with it? We're trying to be gracious. I commend that at the highest level. We want to be gracious, but it is devoid of truth. God's grace is not like that. There is true grace. The common element in each of those examples is the absence of truth. Here's the problem. Without truth, grace is not true grace. It's twisted grace, and it produces twisted people. That's the problem. Jesus was pleased as man with men to dwell. He was willing to endure all of the twistedness of truth and the twistedness of grace, our truthless grace and our graceless truth. He was willing to endure all of that and to live among us, to demonstrate to us His perfections and His glory and His love. True grace. There is no conflict between truth and grace. And let me, just one more little comment, just to kind of drill down in our mind. Think about it. What is grace? If someone were to ask you, your child asks you, somebody asks you, Sunday school, whatever, what is grace? We would probably quickly come to mind kind of a catechism, you know, children's church, Sunday school type thing. Okay, grace is unmerited favor. Well, unmerited means it's not deserved. Right? Favor means blessing. Grace is unmerited favor. It's undeserved blessing. Grace is something positive that we really didn't earn, that we don't deserve. It's a kindness, it's a blessing, it's a positive, it's a help that maybe we need, but we didn't deserve it. We maybe didn't even want it because we weren't even aware that we needed it. Undeserved favor. Unmerited blessing. But here's the thing. The truth about grace is that even though it's undeserved blessing and unmerited favor, the truth about grace is that someone else suffered so that God could show such favor to sinners. That's the truth about grace. We get undeserved favor and blessing from God, not because God is just so gracious so He just kind of looks away from the truth and just overlooks our sin. No. The true grace of God is that God dumps blessings upon us because someone else suffered for our sins. That's the true grace of God. God does not look the other way with sin. God always opposes sin, even a believer's sin. God promises that He will chasten us when we get off track. The idea that somehow we just ought to accept one another. We ought to accept. Listen, that can bleed into the Christian church's thinking, and then we're just supposed to accept. What's wrong with accepting? Nothing. But we also often seek to exhort and testify about the true grace of God. Lest a person just buys into this idolatry of just accepting. And find out too late that they moved away from the truth. What is so amazing about grace is that we enjoy grace because Jesus endured judgment. This is the true grace of God. And so what I want to do is to go through this book, 1 Peter, and show you 8 times that Peter used the word grace. So we're going to have to fly. Okay, so if you want to take a note, look at it later, it'd be great. But there are 8 times that he used the word grace. We'll just trace the teaching of what grace is and what true grace is through this epistle, okay? Look at the first one. It's over in chapter 1, verse 2. Chapter 1, verse 2. And I'll try not to take time to look at any of the context. Yeah, you can do that later. I've already done that, but I just won't be able to do it with you. But notice with me, chapter 1 and verse 2. Elect, according to the foreknowledge of God the Father. Okay? You got it? the Father. Through sanctification of the Spirit, got it? God the Spirit. Unto obedience and sprinkling of the blood of Jesus Christ, God the Son. Look, grace unto you and peace be multiplied. True grace is the beginning. True grace is the foundation. True grace is the introduction for the whole. True grace is, that's what true grace is. It is the entire Christian experience is based on truth and grace as a foundation. This is foundational. If we don't get truth and grace together, true grace, if somehow we let the pendulum swing all the way over here to grace and we abandon truth, it can take that which is so virtuous, the grace of God, and become twisted up. Or the pendulum can swing the other way, boom, all the way over there, and we're all about truth and we lose sight of grace. Both are extremes. Both are wrong. The Father's foreknowledge, the Spirit sanctifying, and the sacrifice of Christ, they're all true grace. Look at the second one. True grace is undeserved. Chapter 1, verse 10. Of which salvation the prophets have inquired and searched diligently, who prophesied of the grace that should come unto you. True grace, undeserved. Watch verse 10. Now, I don't want to go back over because we did this very carefully, but back in June we were in this text. But isn't it amazing again to recognize the verse 10 talks about prophets? First century, they wouldn't have been thinking about Peter or John or Paul. They were thinking about Old Testament prophets. And Peter's saying, of which salvation, which he's already detailed, the prophets, watch, they have inquired. They've searched diligently. They did not know what you and I can experience. They didn't know in detail what we get to live out. Of which salvation the prophets have inquired and searched diligently. Watch this. Who prophesied of the grace that should come unto you. They never experienced it. Not like we do. We are so privileged. It is so undeserved. The prophets told and taught of grace that they never experienced as we have. We suffer today, but when we do, we suffer with the understanding that Jesus suffered too. When the three young Hebrew men were thrown into the fiery furnace, they couldn't comfort themselves with the idea of remembering. Jesus suffered and was pummeled and beaten and broken and put on a cross and died and buried. But he rose! That's our grace, our blessing, our undeserved favor. That no matter what suffering, what reversal, what difficulty, what hardship that we face, we could go back and see, but I have Jesus. I have him. I love him. True grace does not avoid suffering. It does not deny suffering. True grace endures suffering no matter what. And one of the reasons why is we go back to this and we recognize that truth. Hey, look at another one. This really is right along with it. Verse 13. True grace endures. Verse 13 of that first chapter. Wherefore, gird up the loins of your mind. We went over that before. Gird up the loins of your mind is this idea of pull things in tight and think carefully. Be sober. Be serious. This is really important. This is not a game. Hope. Watch this. Hope to the end for the grace that is to be brought unto you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Suffering can tempt you and me as believers to doubt and fear and question. But true grace enables us to hope to the end for the revelation of Jesus Christ. What are we saying? We are saying this life is hard. This life is difficult. This life, there are pains and sufferings and difficulties and misunderstandings and diseases and relational stresses and just on and on and on. It's true. But we don't give up because we hope to the end for the revelation of Jesus Christ. I'm going to see him one day. I'm going to see this one, we think. This one who healed the lame. He could heal all lame now, today, too, but he doesn't. I mean, if he could open the eyes of the blind, raise the dead, Why do we still have cemeteries today? I mean, if he could heal leprosy, why do we still wrestle with COVID? Because God is not so concerned that somehow we have utopia here. God works in us through this suffering so that we love Him more and enjoy and experience and learn about His true grace. And we endure because I'm going to see Him one day. True grace endures. Look at chapter 3, verse 7. Here's an interesting passage. Verses 1 through 6 talks about wives. It begins by saying, likewise ye wives. Verse 7 says, likewise ye husbands. And he goes on and says, likewise ye husbands, dwell with them, the wife, according to knowledge. How do you do that? Giving honor unto the wife. Why do you do that? As unto the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered. Peter even comes down to marriage and talks about true grace in marriage. It's amazing to think about marriage. Think with me for a moment. Not to get way off on that. We want to focus on grace. But is it not astonishing to realize, just think afresh again, that the way God created the universe of men is that a man and a woman come together in marriage, in physical intimacy, and they produce an eternal soul. Talk about the grace of life. It's amazing. How amazing it is that God's true grace, what God's true grace accomplishes, that in marriage, bringing a child to life. And we recognize with true grace, physical intimacy is not about getting needs met. It's about meeting needs. And the very thing that becomes something that where there's a whole industry built up with, from, you know, it's often called the oldest profession in the world, you know. All about an individual getting his needs met, even paying for that. I'm trying to be discreet, of course. Think of that. Think of pornography today. What's it all based on? It's based on what God created to be the irreducible minimum purity of a man and woman coming together. That is His way of continuing the human race. And yet how twisted and broken it is. True grace enables married couples to meet each other's needs. And the ultimate fruit is a new, eternal soul. Hey, here's another one. Look at chapter 4, verse 10. This is number 5 already. We're making good time. It's great. As every man hath received the gift, even so minister the same one to another, as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. True grace serves others. That's this idea of minister. As every person, every human being has received the gift, there's certain giftedness, we have certain abilities, we have certain skills, we have certain things that we can do. Some people, as I said before, are maybe really good as an athlete, but they stink in the classroom. Others are really great in the classroom, and they stink as an athlete. What do you think you ought to do?
Well, if you're an athlete, you ought to just really put that in the back burner and be a better student.
No. Go with your strengths. Sometimes we can spend a lot of time, and maybe someone is really good with children, but they get frustrated that they can't sing. And so they try to focus all their effort on singing. No, go with your strengths. God made you a certain way. Hey, if you're a rose, don't try to be a daffodil, man. Right? As every man hath received the gift, even so minister the same one to another. What's God saying? God gives us gifts, not so that we can enjoy them. No, so that we can minister to one another. God gives us giftedness so we can use that for others, not for ourselves. Not so people look at us and see what great people we are, great Christians we are. No, God gifts us uniquely and individually So that by His grace we can serve one another, and that it all functions as a body in the work of the Lord, and all functions within the church, and we see parts fitting together that are very different. The right hand and the left hand, but they just fit together. That is the demonstration of this manifold grace of God. True grace serves others. All service, when we're believers and we understand true grace, we recognize that service is not merely a duty, it's a delight. Serving in with true grace, it's simply sharing the gift of true grace that we have received. There's three more. True grace is humble. We went over this just recently. Chapter 5, verse 5. Likewise, ye younger, submit yourselves unto the elder, yea, all of you be subject one to another, and be clothed with humility. For God resisteth the proud, and giveth grace to the humble. Why is it that God resists the proud? He's writing to believers. Well, we like the second part of the phrase. God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Yes, God gives grace, and we want that grace. That's great. But why is this put together? God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Why doesn't God just give grace to everyone? Why doesn't God say, well, this proud person, you know, we just need to just pour on the grace for you? It's because God's grace is true grace. And the truth is, this broken, humble person needs and is receptive. They understand that they need God's help. And so giving that humble person grace is going to demonstrate God's true grace. On the other hand, the proud person, to give them grace is to make them more proud. I don't need God. All is well. True grace. True grace is humble. Experiencing God's true grace leads away from self. It leads away from pride. Experiencing true grace leads us to greater humility, not pride. And as we experience God's grace and we humble ourselves and we experience more grace and we humble ourselves, we experience more grace. And it's a marvelous spiral that one leads to the other. You say, well, which comes first, humility or grace? And what's the answer? Yes. It's like the chicken and egg question. You say, what comes first? God comes first. Always, in everything. What is our role? You can't get more grace by somehow going to God and storming the gates of heaven. God is not some dictator that sits in heaven and just says, well, you know, you humble yourself enough and then I'll... No! God is a gracious God that is just constantly, you can hear the beeping up of this massive truck getting closer and closer to you, and He dumps grace all over you all the time. Grace. True grace. It's humble. And then here, look at chapter 5, verse 10. We looked at this last week briefly. The God of all grace, who hath called us unto eternal glory by Christ Jesus, after that ye have suffered a while, make you perfect, establish, strengthen, settle you. True grace is all of God. He is the God of all grace. Isn't it amazing that in the exact same verse, it starts with grace, it ends with people like you and me becoming perfect, establish, strengthen, settle you. It takes us from being all this fickleness and whimsical, and we don't understand why we were born, and we don't understand what life is all about, and we really don't know what to do, and we're all confused and all of that. And He takes us from that to stable and secure and solid. He takes us from being kind of like, you know, the leaf that you see outside that just is just blowing, and it's just all over the place, and it's dried up and it's dead. God takes us from that to where we're like a cotton picking Hannah. There you go. A cotton picking oak tree, she told me about. Was it Hannah? No, it was somebody was saying something about. Anyway, I don't know why I say cotton picking, but anyway, yeah, He takes us to be an oak tree. I mean, you picture a leaf. You picture an oak tree. That's what God is saying to us here. He takes people like us. By His grace. To take us to make us mature and established and strengthened and settled now. Not just in heaven. Now. That's what He's doing in our lives. But between that God of all grace in this verse, and establish, strengthen, and settle, it says after that ye have suffered a while. And that very suffering that God designs to work the oven or to work the vice or to work the pressure to mold us as that clay, that very suffering that God designs to take us after we've suffered a while to perfect, establish, strengthen, and settle you, that exact same suffering is what Satan wants to use to cause us to say, God's a bully. God is not good. I don't, you know, and we push against God. Yeah, the God of all grace. All grace is of God. God's grace, His true grace, is what turns suffering inside out to become a blessing in disguise. God graciously works in us to this end. And then the final one is what we already read. He begins with grace, chapter 1, verse 2. He ends with grace, chapter 5 and verse 12. I have written briefly, exhorting and testifying that this is the true grace of God wherein ye stand. True grace is how we stand. What does it mean? What is he saying when he comes to the end and he says, this is the true grace of God wherein ye stand? Here's the point. True grace is how we stand in contrast. What is the contrast of standing? It's falling. It's falling. This metaphor of, we sing sometimes, stand up for Jesus. What are we saying? We'll joke sometimes, we'll say, well, you can't sing this sitting down. And standing up for Jesus is not being on 2 feet. Standing up for Jesus is not the opposite of laying down or sitting on a pew. Understand that this metaphor of standing up for Jesus is the idea of enduring and consistently plowing and keeping at it, and no matter what happens, keeping our eyes on Him and living for Him and loving Him and making progress toward Him rather than falling away. This is the true grace wherein ye stand. We are enabled to stand firmly only by true grace, only by truth and grace. We're commanded to stand firm in God's true grace. So Peter concludes, I've written briefly, exhorting and testifying that this is the true grace of God wherein ye stand. This whole book of 1 Peter, as we conclude our study of it from May till now, this whole book, Peter is arguing that a believer's suffering does not prove that we're wrong about true grace. No. Our suffering does not prove that we're wrong about true grace. In contrast, it is the very suffering that as we suffer well, we demonstrate that God is the one who is enabling us to do that. And it proves our love for Him that transcends and goes beyond any reversals or struggles or problems or trials or suffering that we experience here. Suffering is the very platform that demonstrates to everybody that watches that we love God and that our lives are about Him and that His true grace is enabling something in our lives that's way beyond any merely human effort. So may God help us, each of us, to stand strong and not fall, and to stand true in His grace, no matter what He calls us to endure.